Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, opening weekend playoff basketball is here. We got a couple of tied 1-1 series. We want to talk about those, what we saw, what we're anticipating moving forward. We then look at some of the blowouts that we saw. We look at some of the upsets that we saw. We go to our panic meter. How concerned should we be about certain teams in the first round of the playoffs? And we shift to the W side. I have some thoughts. I have some things percolating in the old brain of mine. I toss some things over Steve's way. Want to talk through some of the storylines heading into training camp, heading into media days, and ultimately heading into preseason action. We'll talk about a few things, and we end with awesome news concerning Aliyah Boston. We hope you have fun with us. Let's get after it. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve! It is playoff time, brother. How are you?
Oh, feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. I was debating on doing the intro or not. I've been pretty locked in on the first round of the playoffs, but it's that time of the year. Time to get locked in. Time to talk about the games in an efficient manner. I'm ready to go. Let's talk some hoops.
Let's do the heckin' thing then. We have 8 series underway. We have 8 game ones. Then we have 3 game twos to talk through. We got some tied series in the first round, Steve. And so let's get into a pair of those. Let's get into last night's action. We start out west with the Denver Nuggets and the Minnesota Timberwolves. An electric game one, a 116-105 victory for the Nuggets. Strong second half for them. Game two last night, 119-114 win for the Minnesota Timberwolves. Fantastic defense down the stretch of that game from the Minnesota Timberwolves. Lots of things happening there. So, Steve, I want to open this up. What have been some of your major takeaways through the first two games of this series? How have you felt about this back and forth so far between these two teams that have faced each other quite a bit over the past few seasons?
I mean, somewhere around this, like the early parts of that second quarter, in my brain, I was like, oh, this is going to be one of those Denver-Minnesota games. And, like, that's the positive of these teams having a familiarity. But there's a back-and-forth element that comes with the playoffs, and these teams know each other. And I think when you get to this part of the season, especially in today's NBA, right, it's so hard to sustain the high level of play. And I know sometimes you look at a team and say, oh, they can't do X, Y, Z. That team is also very good. And so the minute a team lets down, the other team can pounce because they can do similar things. I think – overall, when you look at what they did, like you get to halftime, we're square, right? Minnesota had 22 made field goals, 19 assists. Denver had 22 made field goals, 18 assists. Denver shot 12 of 18 in the first, 6 of 9 from 3. Minnesota shot 14 of 20 in the second, 6 of 9 from 3. And so there are mirrors to this. And I think if the elements of the contributions that Minnesota got from so many different players, Anthony Edwards and the pressure point that he is, Denver having to work to mix schemes against them. Do we want to be at the level? Do we want to get to drop? Minnesota saying, hey, Anthony Edwards, mix in some pass and cut. Let's see if we can get you going in a different way. JaDy McDaniels starting that second half and saying, actually, I'd like to score. Nikola Jokic in game two saying, actually, I would like not to shoot, and we're going to cook. Jamal Murray off to a great start. The back and forth of it all where Naz Reid and Julius Randle, the lineup where you're raising your eyebrow, is the one that helps bring them back in the second quarter with contributions from Bones Highland and, you know, the swagger of Adesumu. And I think these teams are put so much different types of pressure on each other. To the heart of what happened in game two, I think you have to give a salute to Rudy Gobert. I think you got to give a salute to JaDy McDaniels. You got to give a salute to Julius Randle. They were so key, and also Dante DiVincenzo. Like, this is a team effort for Minnesota. And realizing once Denver kind of let down defensively in that second quarter, oh, we have an opportunity. This is our chance. Let's make it happen. And so that's the dynamic. Denver had their defense humming in game one and in the first quarter of game two. That defense fell. Now Minnesota sees an opportunity to capitalize. They get to cooking, and now we're in a back and forth. And the interesting part was fourth quarter. Okay, Jamal Murray, Nikola Jokic, two-man game. Denver, JaDy McDaniels, elite screen navigation in that game. Rudy Gobert did everything he needed to in that game. They didn't have their fastball, Nikola Jokic or Jamal Murray. So we didn't get the ultimate pressure point to where, okay, you don't feel comfortable with this. Minnesota gave the effort and took things away. So I just thought, overall, the dynamic between these two teams is so fun to watch. And now it's a 1-1 series. It's up in the air, guys.
It is up in the air indeed. And, like, watching these two teams that, again, have played each other quite a bit over the past two or three seasons, like the counter punches between these two. You go to the game one and the Minnesota Timberwolves are like, yeah, actually, we are here. You're not going to have a good time on either end of the floor. Nikola Jokic, you are turning the ball over a bunch. We're forcing turnovers. We're getting Ant going early. It's a lot of fun. Denver battles back. They ultimately win this game. You fast forward to the game two. All of the threes that it felt like the Nuggets were missing in that game one, how about we knock down literally all of them to start the game in game two with a nice little sprinkling of Minnesota is going to foul every three-point shooter in sight for like a three-minute stretch, which popped me as I was watching live.
You didn't like the slow-mo of Anthony Edwards and they got four and ones?
Four. Yes. I'm just like, what is happening here? And so, like, it's funny just watching the counterpunching from a broader perspective, right? You narrow down on what they want to do about the stars. We talked about this in the lead up. Anthony Edwards, how often was he going to see two on the ball? How often was he going to see kind of some loading up on the floor behind the action from Denver? How many times are we going to overload the floor? Anthony Edwards, and we are keeping an eye on like how healthy the knee is for Ant too. That was a quiet subplot of this game too as well. 21 drives for Anthony Edwards through two games. Like, this is someone that you would be surprised if he averages 21. He's only logged 21 through the first two games. Some of that is testing out what the explosion is. A lot of that is Denver saying, we are going to show you bodies all of the time. And watching him navigate through these first two games has been fascinating. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think that's an important point to remember. When Anthony Edwards wants to boogie and go one-on-one, Denver is planting help defense. And we've seen possessions where Anthony Edwards is like, hey, please get out of the way, clear the wing. And Christian Brown or insert Denver defender is like, I'm not moving. And Nikola Jokic or insert big is saying, I'm at the baseline. And so you're going to see kind of boxes and elbows. And so it's been interesting to watch the concepts as far as Denver deciding, actually, no, you get a one-on-one isolation on the wing, baseline help is being shown. You go one-on-one at the top, we have our help, boxes and elbows, or we're going to show really help. We're going to try and take away your driving lanes. And Anthony Edwards, having the balance of game one, where I think he had a lot of patience and made good decisions as far as making the right reads, getting off it quick, which I think is a key point. Game two, didn't lose that, but also was like, I would like to shoot the basketball. And so I'm going to shoot the basketball because we need my blend of playmaking and scoring. And so the heart of it was just kind of finding ways to poke at Denver and see how many different coverages and schemes they would throw at him. You know, Aaron Gordon's going to be a switch. You know, Jokic, are you going to be at the level? If we get a rescreen, what are you going to do on that second action? If I pass and I cut, what are you going to do on that? And kind of testing and kind of poking at them, because ultimately this is playoff time. Your pressure points are going to get the ball. They are going to make the defense react and you have to play out of it, and they are going to have to make plays. And so you keep an eye on what Ant-Man has done, but you know there's a different game in his back pocket to a degree. And that's why Denver is trying to throw as many different coverages as they can at him. And that's why it's important to see Ant kind of cycle through them during different moments of the game.
Yeah, I think to that point, again, only 21 drives through the first two games for Ant. 1.35 points per possession on those trips, though. Like, I think the Wolves will certainly take that. You want to see more volume. And that's where I got a little nervous, you know, in parts of game one where I was threading the game. And I'm just like, I love how patient Ant has been to start this game. I love the reads that he's making. He's getting off the ball when he needs to. He has to be careful not to be so in processing mode that he actually bogs the offense down while he's trying to survey what's happening there. So I was keeping an eye on like how quickly he was making his decisions, how quickly he was making those reads. You get the game too. Like, it was a possession, midway through the first where he is dribbling the ball up the court and then he's grabbing at his knee and it's like, ooh, well, that doesn't seem ideal. I think that played a role in, I am taking these jumpers because I don't know. Like, y'all are showing a bunch of help anyway. I also don't know how much I can do right now. So I'm going to try to get the shot making going. And so I'm just like, ooh, is Ant okay? I'm typing this out in my notes. And then you fast forward a little bit. Anthony Edwards has the Jamal Murray assignment defensively. I'm just like, well, I guess he's okay. And then he hits the snatchback three in the left corner against Tim Hardaway Jr. I was like, all right, yeah, he's definitely all right. And I guess he's fine. So, like, it's been fascinating to see that. And then you flip to the Denver side, and it's like, what do we do with Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic? Jaden McDaniels has his hands full if he is picking Jamal Murray basically at half and then having to navigate whatever screens Nikola Jokic sets. The Nuggets have also sprinkled in the invertible to where we're going to have Jamal Murray screen for Nikola Jokic. Let's see, Rudy, are you ready to navigate? Do y'all really want to switch this? If I get downhill, I might open it up pick and pops for Jamal Murray now. something that we got to see a little bit of in game two. So like watching that dynamic, in addition to just the way that the Nuggets want to space around this kind of thing, has been a fascinating battle through the first two games. In game one, I ended up making a tweet about it. 18 possessions where you got some version of the Murray Jokic two-man game with flat spacing. 18 points on 11 possessions is insane. Game two, it was not that. You get to the end of the game two in particular, and you hit this at the top of the show, so I won't hang here too long. Fantastic job by Jaden McDaniels navigating. Fantastic job by Nikola Jokic battling, or Rudy Gobert, rather, battling with Nikola Jokic. Them mixing in, you know, that final shot for Jamal Murray before the game was officially over, where they just mix in the late switch, which I don't think Jamal Murray was anticipating. Oh, wait a minute, y'all are switching this to close this out and potentially end the game. Like, that is fascinating. But those two did such a good job late in game against Denver.
I think that's a big key. And I'll add to the point where I think that, and I'm going to get booed for this, but it's fine. Denver wanted to go, I don't want to say quick two because it's not March, but hey, let's keep our time out. Rudy Gobert's on the floor. We'll get a traditional coverage and we'll play out of it, get something quick, foul, keep our time out, see what we got to do. Mm-hmm. When Rudy Gobert executed that, actually, my drop is a switch, Jaden McDaniels sticks to Jokic, that was a really excellent move from Minnesota, I felt like. And so you can dislike Jamal Murray deciding, oh, cool, Rudy Gobert, I'll take the step back. But again, you have to realize basketball players think they can do really good things at different times. And so if he's made it, you'd feel different about it. And so I'd add that point right there very quickly. I think the dynamic in the second half was very interesting because you saw kind of early in the third, middle of the third, where Denver kind of got to some of that Aaron Gordon, Jamal Murray, Nikola Jokic action. Because Nikola Jokic didn't really want to shoot the ball in the first quarter. He just did the, actually, I don't have to shoot bit. And it worked for Denver. They had movement. They had pressure points. They were making shots. It was fine. We kind of advanced to, hey, you may need to shoot and score the ball. And then, you know, they get to the elbow action and they were able to have a flare to get Jamal Murray to the side. And we play out of that and get to the moments where it's like, and this is the thing about Jokic. I think a lot of times everyone thinks, oh, he's unstoppable. It's not so much that he's unstoppable. It's that he makes the plays that makes him such a pressure point that you forget how much of a bucket getter he is, because we get a flare and now, okay, you don't necessarily feel comfortable. We fake a pick and roll. I drive, bop. I drive again, bop. I pick and pop, bop. And now I've delivered a solution where it's like, hey, you have to deal with this. Minnesota dealt with that in the fourth with Jaden McDaniels. And again, I want to absolutely say his screen navigation was out of sight. Like, Jaden McDaniels against Jamal Murray is one of my favorite things to watch in playoff basketball. So I want to give a salute. But I think both sides walk away. Minnesota, you know, got the win on the road. Huge. For Denver, your defense can't be what it was for a majority of the last three quarters. And offensively, your whole bit is we can do Jokic Murray in the end of the game, but if your closers lose their location and the batters hit a home run, you blew a save.
You blew a save. That's what, look at, Steve is here. It is playoff time indeed. I guess I want to close with like Denver defense thoughts before we move to the next series, because I have been conflicted when watching Denver defensively through the first two games, because I think the highs have been extremely high to where we can mix in Jokic and drop Jokic at the level. I feel like second quarter of game two, they went to kind of like a zone adjacent look for a couple of possessions. I was like, ooh, this looks kind of funky. We'll see how long they stick with it. Didn't stick with it long. I was like, okay, they're mixing in the looks. And this is something that you in particular have talked about quite a bit with Denver this year. I was like, hey, I see that the Denver defense isn't at the level that it needs to be right now, but will there be payoff in the playoffs that they've tried so many different things? And on the high end, we've seen a lot of that. On the other side, look at moments in game one, particularly the start in game one. You saw it in the second half of game two. Like, Minnesota feels way more comfortable attacking in the half court than they probably should. To where it is Jokic in a drop. No, we are getting all the way downhill. Whether that is Anthony Edwards after he started feeling better, Julius Randle, who really set the tone with his drives, particularly in that first half of game two. Like, well, no, we can play out of this. We get Jokic at the level with these ant pick and rolls, even if you're showing a little bit of help behind that. The amount of closeout attacks that Jaden McDaniels has had from the corner through the first two games was like, ooh, this is the inherent weak point of this particular coverage, but you want some of this to be tighter than what it is. And then, as we were joking before the pod, Steve, I'm like, let me get the Jokic number so I can sprinkle the pod. 67 picks defended through the first two games for Nikola Jokic. The Nuggets have allowed 0.71 points per possession on those trips. Would easily be the best mark in the NBA if extrapolated across the entire regular season. So it's just like, I am watching the games. There have been key moments through both of these games and this series where Denver's defense has gotten dinged in a way where I'm like, ooh, Minnesota feels comfortable here. But you've also seen the good from them. And so heading into this game three, the series shifts to the road, oiled up, et cetera. How much of this Denver defense is going to travel? And more importantly, how consistently will that defense perform at a high level, regardless of what we decide to do? Like, that looms very large for me.
I think to go very quick, they just cannot give up the type of breakdowns they give up in game two. It can't be that. And so I think the versatility and the willingness to try different things is fantastic. You may get yourself in a scenario where you stick to the zone a little bit too much, or you stick to a certain coverage too much, but the fact that you're willing to swing the bat looms large for them as far as being able to mix things up. I think that's important. It's on them to take away the little things. They were extremely locked in game one. In game two, they were not locked in. Switches were not given. Rotations were not great. Not keeping the ball in front. They have to know their winning formula can't be that defensively.
Yeah, it's got to be fun. Last quick note I'll add on the Minnesota defense front, and then we can move, because you mentioned how important the Randall and Naz Reid front court was in game two in particular. Like, very interesting to see, because I was very stressed out in game one. It's like, ooh, Jokic is just having fun with whatever four is defending him when Rudy Gobert is on the bench. In game two, it felt better. It was interesting to me to see how far in, like, Naz Reid was behind Julius Randle when he was defending a pick and roll in those two big lineups. It's like, okay, they're starting to find some things that does open up some skips and things for Denver offensively, so we'll see what that looks like in game three. But nice adjustment there. Let's now move to the other series that is tied at 1-1, Steve. Knicks Hawks. Ooh, buddy, this has been a fascinating series through the first two games. I don't know how many people are pleased right now through the first two games of the series if we're looking at these fan bases. But a 113-102 win for the Knicks in game one, a 107-106 win for the Hawks in game two as the series shifts to Atlanta later this week. Same broad question for you, Steve. What have become your bigger takeaways through the first two games? What's excited you about this one? What are you keeping your eye on heading into game three?
I mean, I think it's been a beautiful back and forth between these two teams. I think one of the bigger questions that we both had was, okay, how will Atlanta want to guard Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns? And then can the Knicks unlock Karl-Anthony Towns to a degree? And we saw both teams trying to figure out what they could do. On the other hand, both question we had is, hey, what can Atlanta do in the half court to cycle through some of the New York matchups and put pressure on New York in a different way? And can they hit those right buttons? We've seen both teams struggle. We've seen both teams do well. And I think it was interesting as far as game one goes where, okay, the Hawks don't want to give a switch with Onyeka Okongwu if they can help it. And we'll give a switch if it's Mo Gay, but we won't give that switch. And the Knicks figured that out, exploited that in game one. And Karl-Anthony Towns got unlocked. They were pull things away. They had the off-ball actions as well. They were layering different things. It was a good time for the Knicks. Game two, okay, let's see if we can keep the off-ball actions going. The Hawks were better defensively as far as taking that off the menu to a degree, which I thought was very interesting and fascinating. But there were still some question marks as far as, okay, what's our coverage with Onyeka Okongwu against Kat? And how much do we want to put a wing on Karl-Anthony Towns, how much we want to mop that up? The Knicks kind of going back and forth with that. I thought the Knicks did a great job in game two of saying, actually, that's cool. We're going to drive the basketball. So whatever you're taking away, we are going to respond with drives. And I thought they were really aggressive, really on point, taking things down, had a really good start. You know, second quarter, they put the bench lineup in. Atlanta's like, ha, stops. We are now doing the Atlanta Hawks transition deal. Interesting dynamic, right? But you get again to the back. Of course, Karl-Anthony Towns feels better in the third quarter. Jalen Brunson feels like he's humming. They want to attack Dyson Daniels. There's a lot of things going on right there. But you get to the fourth, right? And I still remember, right? Two different points I'm going to make. One, I thought Jose Alvarado was about to get the Madison Square Garden on fire.
Oh, what a minute.
With CJ McCollum. Like, I think there was, like, one, the exchange with him and CJ McCollum was interesting. Two, there was a moment where he had a swipe down that they called a foul that I thought the building was going to explode if he had gotten that steal. But CJ McCollum nodding and saying, I like it. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of how good CJ. Oh yeah, man. I don't know if you guys are aware of how good CJ McCollum is. And he literally tried to shoot immediately after that moment, missed like two or three, right? But let me tell you, in that fourth quarter, when it was closing time, I think he remembered the moment he shared with Jalen Brunson. I think he remembered the moment he shared with Jose Alvarado. And he reminded everyone, just in case y'all forgot, I am a bucket. And if you forgot, the game is about a bucket. And I'm about to deliver several of these buckets. So Jalen Brunson come here, bop, bop, bang. Oh, cool, that's OG Anunoby. Great, whatever. Left side empty, fade away. That's... I truly would wonder how the Knicks fan base feels to where Trae Young did what Trae Young did, right? And then fast forward, and it's CJ McCollum in the garden being like, Also, shout out to CJ being like, I'm not a villain. I'm a good guy, and I have kids.
Yeah. that fried me. And then the post-game presser, I wish I remember exactly asked the question. It's like, hey, it felt like you were really going after the Jalen Brunson matchup. Is that a matchup that you like? He's like, what do you think? Porter's like, yeah. CJ's like, yeah, deadpan. I was like, well, but you're not a villain, though. Okay. But no, that absolutely fried me. But CJ has been so important for this Hawks group through the first two games. For the Hawks group since he's been there. I think we talked about early on when the Hawks were on their run post-trade trades. Like, okay, well, CJ isn't shooting well, but the playmaking is important. His usage as a screener is important. Just his general spacing is important. You just kind of expect, well, the shot making is going to come along because he's just been doing it for so long. And so for it to shine the way that it did in this game too, obviously it was important and impactful because the Hawks ended up winning the game. But when you think about some of the broader issues that the Knicks, I mean, that the Hawks have had through the first two games in the half court so far, like the shot making for CJ feels even more important because I've been looking at Nikhil Alexander-Walker, like some of the shot making popped in game one. Was like, hey, how much of this do you have? How many easy looks can you create for yourself? I've liked some of his usage as a screener, kind of ghosting out, but consistently, how often can you create clean looks for yourself? Jalen Johnson, very excited for him heading into this series. In the April 6th matchup against the Knicks that we end up doing the live reaction to, like, ooh, Josh Hart was able to bother him. He really wasn't able to get to his spots. We get to game one, Josh Hart's kind of bothered him. He hasn't been able to get to his spots. We get to game two in that first half, and I think, what was it, 4 points in the first half? I was like, hey, I kind of need Jalen Johnson to be able to get to a spot that he is comfortable with. And so it was encouraging to see as the third quarter went on, had moments in the third quarter, game one, too, but the fourth quarter as well, when they were making this run, like, hey, some of the drives are starting to hit now. This is interesting. If you now have CJ mixing in this level of shot making, but his overall usage being versatile, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, you can mix in different looks for him. You now have Jalen Johnson getting downhill. You feel better about this Hawks half-court offense. And then defensively, you touched on it a little bit. Hey, the Hawks tapped the cross-matching bag a little bit. Want to shout out David Lee really quickly. As he tweeted the game, through the first two games, it's been 18 possessions where the Knicks have had Cat being defended by a five. The offensive rating for the New York Knicks, not very great. 12 points through 18 possessions. 18 possessions is not a lot. We saw Dyson Daniels on Cat towards the end of game one. We saw Jonathan Kuminga on Karl-Anthony Towns at the end of game two, and woo boy, Jonathan Kuminga. What a close for him. Timely drives and shot making, taking on the Cat assignment late, but timely rebounding for him. Very impressive close to the game for Jonathan Kuminga, as he was very much stressing me out through the first, what, six quarters of this series, with what he's doing on both ends of the floor. Also thought about you, Steve, as I saw Corey Kispert get the early second quarter minutes. We didn't see Zachary Richichet. I was like, ah, well, this was the X factor for Steve. Let's see what the Kispert minutes look like. But man, just an electric back and forth between these two. The Hawks finding some stuff in the half court, tapping into the cross-matching bag. I am curious to see if there's anything the Knicks feel like they need to overreact to, because this was still very much a winnable game for them last night. There's a lot of conversation about some of the lineup stuff with the New York Knicks we can get to in a little bit, but overall, fascinating two-game stretch for these two teams as they kind of find different things to poke at, different matchups they want to get to, and just working to put each other in a box.
I mean, I think it's still the same questions. If you're New York, you probably are feeling like you left something on the table with the close. Now, I again credit the Atlanta Hawks for just playing a cat and mouse game with New York. And so, yeah, we can talk about Cat being guarded by a wing, but they were trying to get a congruent action and Okongwu and the Hawks defense did not cooperate as far as you're not getting a single coverage. And it actually was funny because it came off a coverage bust with like 5 minutes left. Where Onyeka is thinking, okay, cool, we're keeping this on the side. Dyson Daniels is just guarding Jalen Brunson. Brunson turns the corner, and then it became, actually, you know what, we're not doing that. And so I'm going to jump out. Actually, I'm not here. I'm going to get out and recover. I'm going to find a way to blitz. When I give you the switch that you've been looking for, now we double. I don't know if Atlanta can roll that out to surprise the Knicks again, but the fact that they could do it is good because you need to be able to throw different coverages at teams. How do they react with Cat? What lineups do they want to get to? Do they want to give him the, because I think there were moments where they wanted to give him the ball in the post a couple of times. I don't know if they want to force feed that. And so I think the dynamic is, do you have the comfort of Onyeka Okongwu or insert Big Here's coverage? Because while you cycle through and one, if you don't have something that feels great there, will it matter how much you're able to mix if the Knicks know what's coming?
No, I think that's fair. I think just circling back to Jalen Brunson going after Onyeka Okongwu the way he did, like, it was very impressive to your point. The Hawks just kind of mix again different looks. We'll go show and recover with Onyeka. We'll turn this into a late. We'll just switch this and then we'll double behind it sometimes. I'm just like, okay, they are mixing in different things. And part of, you know, going back to the David Lee tweet, like, part of the offensive rating being low is that the Hawks were able to get stops there. But in relation to Cat himself, if it is just Brunson Hart two-man game at the top of the key because Brunson is hunting the matchup, that does inherently just kind of leave Cat chilling in the corner. And as Jonathan Kuminga had that matchup, I have had my quibbles with Jonathan Kuminga as an off-ball defender. The Warriors have had their quibbles with Jonathan Kuminga as an off-ball defender. Warriors fans have had their quibbles with Jonathan Kuminga as an off-ball defender. If you're telling me his only job is stay in front of Karl-Anthony Towns, do not let him get a touch. You do not have help responsibilities. You do not have rotation responsibilities. You are just putting paws on this guy and making sure he does not catch the ball. Jonathan Kuminga can execute that job. And so that just puts the spotlight on Jalen Brunson. Do you have the shot making going for us? He didn't have it consistently enough in the close of game two. And so that's where you get that. So I'm just kind of fascinated if we do get into, if Atlanta decides we're going to tap into more of the cross matching, particularly the late in games. I don't think it's going to be a start of the game thing for them. Or at least not consistently. If it's a late thing, can you find the blend of Jalen Brunson Hunt's a matchup because he's really good? And let's make sure we are involving Cat in some kind of way. Even if it is early screen and then you space and we still get to Brunson, is there a way that we can mix these things in to where it feels more symbiotic than what it felt like at times last night?
I think it was less pure matchup hunting and more pure we can get something out of this coverage. And then Atlanta didn't cooperate. And that became, oh, well, what do we do now? I think when you get into a playoff game, you have your mindset on, okay, we had success with this. We can lean on that. The defense reacts in a certain way, and now you have to make the adjustment. I give the credit to the Hawks defense for basically saying, we're going to be here and we're going to take this way.
No, I think that's fair. I will say just quickly on the Knicks front as we get ready to transition to the next one. Fantastic Mitchell Robinson game, by the way. Just completely changed life for them when he checked in, was just an absolute monster on the offensive glass. I have been very curious through the first two games of like when the Knicks decide we are mixing in Mitchell Robinson plus Cat lineups, especially in light of some of the size issues in the front court that the Hawks have at times. If they're pairing those with Onyeka's on the bench, it's like, ooh, what exactly do we want to do with this? That part is fascinating to me. I've just had a lot of fun with this series. Like, that isn't analysis per se, but the back and forth between these two has been fascinating. The game three is really going to be, let's see, let's pull out the stops. The last thing I actually want to say, as we've gotten some complaints about, or I've seen some complaints about some of the Knicks lineup choices, where they had Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns getting rest at the same time. Mike Brown was asked about this post game. He was like, yeah, like, we've been doing this, or we did this at the end of the year. We've had success with it, et cetera. And I was like, as you know, Steve, I am very much a, if you have two stars or two high-level players, I would like to have one of them on the floor at all times. So, like, conceptually, I'm more so with the criticism. But you look at the actual lineup data, regular season plus playoffs when both Brunson and Cat are available, plus four in 256 minutes when they are both sitting at the same time, Over the last 10 games, pretty much neutral in 51 minutes. You zoom out from March 1st onward, plus 14 in 80 minutes. And we just saw the fourth quarter of game one where it was OG plus bench, and they held serve. The stars both come back in, and they ultimately closed that game out against it. So, like, we have a sample, and we have a very recent sample of, like, why he wants to do this. I'm not pulling my hair out about it yet. It is unfortunate. I think just better offensive execution in general gets you that win. But that's pretty much what I have on the line up front. But last transition. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. No, let's go. Let's go to the Lakers Rockets.
Okay, let's move to Lakers Rockets as that series changed in the onset because Luka Doncic, Austin Reeves, health in the air. And then ahead of game one, it changed again because Kevin Durant suffered an injury in practice, did not play in game one. Not sure as of recording what this firm status for game two is going to be. I know he's going to try to play, but we'll see if he actually does. But you get to that game one, and the Los Angeles Lakers, they win that game first and foremost, 107-98. Steve, the Lakers had their best half-court offensive rating showing in a playoff game in 3 years, and their best in a win in 6 years. I was not anticipating this being LeBron James' super playmaker. Luke Kennard with 27 does not miss a three, and he's just curling off of pin downs, getting into all this mid-range shot making. Marcus Smart post-ups. We got Marcus Smart transition seals. I was incredibly impressed with what the Lakers were able to do against what is still a very good Houston Rockets defense. Did not have a good performance in game one, the Rockets defense, but still a very good high personnel group. Were you surprised at what it looked like for the Lakers? And in general, like...
I was surprised by the blend they were able to hit. You know, I think I felt like, okay, how much of this pressure is going to be on LeBron? How are they going to be able to get Houston in rotation? Was probably some of the questions I had going in early. And okay, you figured, okay, we're going to get Reed Shepard in action against LeBron. LeBron is a screener, someone screening for LeBron. Or we get Reed Shepard and Shingun and pick and roll, and okay, we're going to play out of that. But the off-ball movement that they had, I thought was really impressive as far as being able to get LeBron off pin downs, being able to get Luke Kennard off pin downs, being able to play through Marcus Smart at the post, elbow action with LeBron, and just kind of being able to play out of that and poke at Houston that way. I thought that was a huge key. And so LeBron was able to kind of be LeBron as far as, hey, I can score. You have to pay attention to me. We can put pressure on you, but that wasn't the complete base. I think Luke Kennard, the ways he was used as far as being involved in movement, being willing to come off screens and attack and get downhill and get whatever shot he wanted, that was a massive part of it. But the key important part was the fourth quarter where LeBron just kind of mixed in, I can win these matchups. How do you want to deal with this? Was just a nice layering into game two. So we'll see what that result is. I think the interesting part for me was the Lakers' defense as far as just what they did to Alperen Şengün over the course of the game. I think Alperen Şengün was very aggressive to start that game. And they decided, well, there's no Kevin Durant, so a lot of these coverages that may have been reserved for him, whether it's switch and double or show early help, we're going to throw that at Alperen Şengün. And so that becomes his next challenge, just understanding, okay, when do I have the attack? And so do I want to get a deep seal? Am I working to get a catch against a switch? Is there baseline help? Am I getting off the ball or am I pressing the issue? That's something where you want to keep an eye on it. You want to get him a certain amount of touches, I understand, but you got to credit the Lakers defense for making him think more than he played in that game one as the game wore on.
No, I think that is a big one. Quickly to your LeBron point, 8 post-ups, 1.3 points per possession on those trips. In the fourth quarter ones where, yeah, I'm going to dribble 8 times and hit you in the chest. And then reestablish position if I need to and hit you again, sprinkling the lefty hook and then the sky hook that we're not going to talk about. It's just very funny to watch LeBron say, okay, I guess it is my time to be aggressive now after I've just been playing. Career high 8 assists in the first quarter for LeBron. Playoff career high. Just insane the way he's able to set the table. That part was fun. To the Rockets point in the offense, it is a very dull thing to say that they miss Kevin Durant because of how good he is, what he means for their spacing, what he means for their perimeter creation. But, like, to see that in practice and where you pull up any random Houston Rockets offensive possession you want to, and you are going to see 6 Lakers shoes in the paint, almost independent of what they tried to do. And the Rockets, to their credit, did try to mix in some fun stuff. So Spain looked some different off-ball actions for Reed. Like, they did make attempts to try to move the Lakers' help defense. But, oh, boy, it got muddy in the paint very consistently. And to your point, like being able to mix in, okay, this may be a hard double. We made to show you something different. Alperen Şengün wasn't able to get comfortable on top of that. But to some of the lineups the Rockets were kind of, you know, quote unquote, forced to play with the absence of Kevin Durant. Like, you just had two, three, sometimes four guys that you were okay with shooting from the perimeter on the floor at the same time. And so just even from a lineup synergy standpoint, you hope Kevin Durant is back for the Houston Rockets just so we can balance some of this stuff out. And we can into like our offensively or our heavier offensive units, our heavier defensive units, and it feels like more of a balance than what they had to play in that game one. So we'll see how healthy Kevin Durant is. Very impressive showing from the Lakers on both ends of the floor. I want to quickly shout out DeAndre Ayton as well. Like, he was battling with Alperen Şengün on a lot of those post-ups. Some of the late rolls for him. The Marcus Smart, DeAndre Ayton pick and rolls, very fruitful in that game one as well. But wanted to give the quick salute there. We are going to take a break. But when we return, Steve, it's time to turn to the panic meter. We had some pretty big wins, some surprising losses among these game ones as well. So we're going to dig into those in this next segment. Stay tuned. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. And Steve, it's time to go to the panic meter. Let's start with the top seed in the Eastern Conference, the Detroit Pistons. The Orlando Magic, a 112-101 victory in game one. Game two slated for Wednesday night. So Steve, just on a general note, two-part question for you. What did you see in that game one? And how concerned are you for the Detroit Pistons based on what you saw in game one?
I mean, if the Detroit Pistons were to send a reply, if you asked, how are you doing, it would probably be, I'm good with a period. Could mean a couple different things. I'm good, but also, but I'm good. I think this is an interesting conversation to have with how a lot of people talked about the Orlando Magic just like last week as a concept, as a franchise, as a team, and how a lot of people felt about the Detroit Pistons as a one seed, as a 60-win team. And so it's a fascinating series in that degree. I think what you saw in game one was the formula that Orlando can display. I think for me, we know we talked about it on the warm-up, different places. I think Orlando had a higher playoff ceiling. I don't know if they put themselves in a position consistency-wise to navigate that. But this is a team that when they defend, and I think that was the secret sauce. Everyone has kind of talked about offensive coach. They need offense. Yes, their offense slipped. They made attempts. We saw the formula in November when they had a top 10 offense and defense as far as what they can be. In the half court against Detroit, they said, you know what? Our half court tempo going to be a little slower, but we can control tempo that way. So you have to defend us, and we have high confidence players. The one thing you can't doubt about the Orlando Magic, Paolo Banchero, Franz Wagner, Jalen Suggs, Desmond Bane, believe in who they are. And you saw that on display early and often in that game one. I'm not talking about, like, you saw the nods and the yeahs. Like, this wasn't like 10-2 run. Yeah, we're cooking. This was no, we're just cooking in general. I think that was a big part of why they were able to respond to every Detroit surge, right? Like, as far as every time Detroit rallied back, got it close, tied it, Orlando was like, here's 8 points, deal with us. But I think the defense that they displayed was so important as far as being able to mix coverages early and occasionally switch Wendell Carter Jr. out onto Cade Cunningham, but also, you know, not necessarily give it every single time. So, yeah, we're going to weak side help and rotate, but we might do these switches. We're going to try and take Jalen Duren's roles away and lower his overall impact. And so you saw the back and forth, Detroit deciding, okay, we can't get Jalen Duren rolling that way. Let's get some off-ball actions for Duncan Robinson, see if we can tap it that way. As the game progresses, get some pin downs, pass and catch for Cade Cunningham and see if we can unlock him that way. Let's show a lot of help on Cade Cunningham's drives. And so how many matchups is he winning? And when he wins those matchups, how much help are we showing? And are you making us pay for that? And that, to me, feels like the back and forth. That's where Orlando can live. When their defense is playing at a high enough level to bother and take away the Detroit Pistons' attack, and then we can get into, hey, those shots you say you can live with or you don't like that we took in the fourth quarter, we sure took them and we sure made them, because they made them pay in that fourth quarter to an absurd degree. And so I think for me, it's okay. It's a reminder of what Orlando can be on both ends of the floor when they're fully locked in and bought in. They have nothing to lose. And we saw that kind of effort in game one. For Detroit, it's a reminder of what they have to do to have success. And I think the secret part of this game was, one, Cade did a pretty good job of understanding the assignment is, okay, there's help. Let me make the right reads. Let me make the right plays. Let me get off of it when I need to. And mixing in, okay, as the game progresses, I need to score. Where are my avenues to get that done? They need scoring behind him. You know, and I'm sure you're going to talk about the non-Cade creation, but it's like they need to score the basketball to a certain degree. But this is the question that I brought up, you know, when we were asking, hey, what do we think about these teams going into the playoffs? What happens when their defense gets dinged? I thought they had an uncharacteristic defensive performance to the degree where their rotations felt late. It felt like they were, you know, this is a team that usually dictates terms, anticipates things defensively. They were reacting a lot, and they were reacting a lot late. So you combine the fact that Orlando could put them in rotations, and Detroit was late on those, and you combine that with Orlando's Paolo's making shots. When Paolo makes shots, the defense pays attention. When the defense pays attention, he now becomes a playmaker. Franz is able to post up different matchups. Desmond Bane's getting to his spots. Jalen Suggs took, what, 9 shots in the first 4 minutes? Like, this is where Orlando can live in this series. So the pressure is on Detroit to say, hey, it can't be this. We need to put the pressure back on you. So I say they're about a 6 right now in my eyes.
Okay, about a 6.
I'm good.
Okay, about a 6.
I'm good, period.
Okay, I'm good, period. It's fantastic. Okay, so I landed at about a 4. And I want to say first, I think you nailed the framing of this in that this Orlando win should be about their defense more than their offense, while also acknowledging the offense was impressive. It ended up being a 98.9 offensive rating in the half court for Orlando. That is solid. That's a 55th percentile mark. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't the Laker game where they had like a 111 or something like that. But we did see a more decisive Paolo Banchero, who also had the jumper going. We did see Franz Wagner slam the door in the fourth quarter. We saw Jalen Suggs just shot out of a cannon in that first quarter, which, if we're doing player shout outs, oh my goodness, Jalen Suggs. Let me kick late clock. Let me hit you with a left hash 3. Let me hit you with a pick. Let me hit you with another 3. Fading to my left again, Robinson. Let me hit you with a pick 6 to go the other way and get an easy basket. Let me get one of the most ridiculous steals you will ever see out of pick and roll, as Kate was trying to flow there, and I'm going to steal that pass. Let me get downhill in transit. He was insane to start the game. You talk about the emoting and the emotion for the Orlando Magic. Jalen Suggs very much and very loudly set the tone on that front. So I want to salute him in particular. But defensively, my goodness, the first thing I tweeted as I was threading the game was like, ooh, Jalen Suggs doesn't have the Cade assignment. Franz Wagner does. They're going size on Cade. They are then mixing and switching against Cade. They might creep up to the level of these pick and rolls down the sideline against Cade. And then behind that, Jalen Duren, you, good sir, all-star, potential all-NBA candidate, over 22 points a game to close the season, you are not going to have a good time against us. We are hitting you on every roll. If we do switch, we are loading somebody behind that to make sure if you try to seal a smaller guy, by the time you turn to catch the ball, there's going to be another person there. Jalen, I wrote about it in my game one takeaway piece, Steve. It was the game one, and it was the November matchup against the Washington Wizards. 2 games where Cade Duren pick and rolls been ran at least 20 times with Jalen Duren not logging a shot attempt or a foul drawn. That does not happen to Jalen Duren. That does not happen to that pick and roll pairing. In Orlando being able to take that off table, put more of a spotlight on, as you alluded to, the non-Cade creation. Because I think for me, okay, who can create their own? Who can create their own? Jalen Duren was showing a high level to do that. And we saw that in games without Cade Cunningham. If your roles aren't there and then you're not comfortable with the drives, because we barely saw those, when you did just get those solo touches, okay, where do we go from there? Duncan Robinson, we're going to run some fun off-ball stuff for you, particularly in the first quarter. If those are being trailed and or you were missing those shots and or you are now getting into foul trouble, as it is now playoff time, which means the whistle always gets tighter against Duncan Robinson, ask me how I know. Okay, where do we go from there? Danish Jenkins, we need some high pick and rolls for you. The Magic are still mixing in their help on drives. If the jumpers aren't going, where do we go? Tobias Harris, we're creating wide open corner threes for you. He misses those shots. Okay, where do we go? It just put the Pistons in such a loop. And Cade finishes his game with 39. Like, as the game went on, as much as I'm complimenting what Orlando was able to do against him, we get mid-second quarter, early third quarter, et cetera. It felt like the rhythm in which Cade wanted to attack. If I'm driving, I'm driving this way. If I'm driving, I'm driving with this cadence. If I'm going to pick and roll, this is when I want to get to my pull-ups. He felt very comfortable by the end of this game. And so that's why ultimately my panic meter is probably at a 4 for Detroit, because I do think they were uncharacteristically bad defensively in this one. Like the overloads against Paolo Banchero were just opening up things. Paolo's in like a little scoop lob. Like he's playing pickup because y'all are pre-rotating poorly. That's not Detroit Pistons basketball. Them getting beat up on the glass the way that they did, that's not really Detroit Pistons basketball. I think they have some low-hanging fruit for them to grab defensively that should make things a little bit tighter. We saw their transition attack pop in this game as well, even though they lost. So, like, that's still there. In any kind of shooting variance from the three-point, like I think they are going to be okay, but they do have to tighten the screws. Like, it is on them to do so, and the Orlando Magic deserve a lot of credit for putting the Pistons in position to have to tighten the screws that way.
Yeah, you credit the Magic. I think you credit the Magic. I know everyone's going to slander the Pistons because we slandered the Magic, so we can't pivot that way. Let's the Pistons, haha. There are just a lot of different dynamics. Like, you had Caris LeVert and Kevin Huerter flying around defensively. The Pistons know who they are. The Pistons went 5 of 11 from 3 in that first quarter, which was everyone's bugaboo about them, but they turned the ball over 6 times. And so they weren't in a good position to capitalize on the ability they made threes. That second quarter was another symbol of the Detroit Pistons seasons where they shot 30% from the field and won the quarter 24-20. So this is not a series that's absolutely decided already, but it is a wake-up call to say, if you do not do X, Y, and Z, we have the size and length to feel comfortable switching against Jalen Duren and Cade Cunningham and showing help. So it's on Cade to mix in, hey, I can win these matchups. How do you feel about this? It's on Jalen Duren to say, hey, I can win these matchups. How do you feel about this? It's on everyone else to kind of understand, okay, when this help is being shown, how are we making this defense pay? But on top of that, the defense has to be a certain level. Both these teams have to defend a certain level to have success. And so that's where I'm at with that one.
There you go. Last thing I'd add before we move to the next game. Asar Thompson, quiet one offensively. There's been just like quiet friction about what his role is offensively and like what the minute load is going to be in light of what he wants defensively. I don't think I want to see him on Desmond Bane in game two. Not because he can't defend him, but it's more like I would much rather just have you on Paolo or Franz so we can just have a bigger body on the committed to those two versus you chasing Desmond Bane around. I think you get to the fourth quarter, in particular with Franz, it's like, okay, well, I'm just bigger than you and I'm feeling confident. I can just get two spots. And so, like, that's one tweak I would like to see in game two, even if it's not wholesale, maybe just more of it. But fantastic stuff for the Orlando Magic. Detroit, you got work to do. Let's move to the other series that we have two games in so far, Steve. Cleveland Cavaliers, 2-game lead over the Toronto Raptors right now, a 126-113 victory in game one, a 115-105 victory in game two. So for the Raptors, Steve, as the series shifts to Toronto later in the week, what is your concern level with the Raptors based on what you've seen through the first two games?
Eight.
Okay.
This is, you know, the text reply is just another day. I don't know what that means. We can't be good. You get that response. You might call your friend depending on how it is. I think it's an interesting concept because Toronto. Cleveland has poked at what Toronto has wanted to do. And I think in my mind, I go to the framing of adjustments, right? I think we talk a lot about adjustments when it comes to the playoffs. I feel like we frame it around successful things that took place that won a game or shifted things. Mm-hmm. Toronto tried a whole lot of things in game two to try and figure out how to compete. And I thought they competed for as long as they possibly could. In game one, they got hammered in pick and roll. Jakob Poeltl, high screen, drop. We're going to get whatever you want out of this. James Harden, do whatever you do. Donovan Mitchell, do whatever you do. We're going to poke at that. On the other end of the floor, Scottie Barnes, we're not going to let you be a pressure point. So anytime you have a matchup or a mismatch, we're going to show help. Or Evan Mobley is just going to pop out of nowhere and take the matchup, and you got to deal with that. Brandon Ingram, it's cool that you like to boogie. Dean Wayne's going to navigate screens. We're going to stay in this drop, and then hopefully your team forgets about you for several minutes at a time. And so for me, game two was like, okay, Toronto, can you get Scottie Barnes in a place where Cleveland has to react? Can you get Brandon Ingram to a space where Cleveland has to react? Can you pick a defense and pick and roll? The answer was kind of, we're going to try. Like, that's the effort's going to be there. Like, the fact that Toronto was able to kind of hang around and stick around in a game where Cleveland's core four at halftime. Do you understand how good they were in that first half? So we're just going to make all the shots and you're not going to feel comfortable. And so that's where it's like you get to Cleveland, Toronto deciding, you know what, we'll start the second half small ball. Call Murray Boyles, get out there. We're going to mix some switches. We're going to feel good about it. The issue is James Harden, Donovan Mitchell liked the Brandon Ingram and RJ Barrett matchup. And that takes a little bit of the punch out of your small ball lineups if they feel like, okay, we can just attack this. And then you're trying to mismatch and throw Mamu on in there and throw him on different people. And Evan Mobley's like, well, you're small, I'm going to seal. Jared Allen, Mr. Aggressive, I'm going to seal. They couldn't necessarily take food off the table. I think that's the toughest part. So offensively, we don't have an anchor. And then defensively, we haven't necessarily gotten them to fully buy into bogging down. You know, and they tried switch. They tried drop. They tried switch and double. They tried so many different things and had success at different points. And then you get to the fourth quarter, and it's James Harden and Donovan Mitchell turning the corner for layups against traditional drop. We did all that circle to the same issue. It's about an 8 for me.
Okay. It's very funny. We've been doing this podcast for a very long time because as I was like prepping for this, I had intention of saying I was torn between being at an 8 or a 3. And so it's very funny that you started with 8. So shout out to us, hashtag synergy. I think for me, I keep coming back to the game too, and to your point that the Raptors tried so many things. And I liked a lot of what the Raptors did conceptually. The Cavaliers deserve credit, as you already talked about, of like poking at the different things that the Raptors did. But I felt pretty good about how the Raptors wanted to tweak things. Hey, we need to play faster. We are going to push off of misses and makes. That means a little bit less if you are going to turn the ball over to the degree that the Toronto Raptors did in game two. Steve, the Toronto Raptors had 9 turnovers in transition in game two.
Yeah.
Not 9 turnovers total, 9 in transition. So much of that was self-inflicted. Brandon Ingram loses the ball, gets bumped out of bounds. Jamal Shedd towards the end of the court, end of the four, he just loses the ball and falls. They had so many opportunities. They forced so many turnovers against Cleveland in the first half in particular. So I was like, okay, they have dialed back some of their pickup points defensively. They are ramping up their physicality off the ball. We're going to, as you already mentioned, we're going to toss in different coverages in terms of pick and roll stuff. We're going to cross match in a different way to bog you down. And they had run out opportunities. This is what we talked about ahead of the series. Like, hey, if they easy ones, and if they can get contributions from their bench, they have a pathway here, despite Cleveland having like the star advantage in this series. And for them to have like 80% of that shine through and it just completely be tossed out over the top rope because they just could not get shots on goal in transition was incredibly frustrating to watch, if I'm going to be completely honest with you. And so like I just look at that as like, well, you can't throw up over yourself when you are fighting to this.
Well, I think this is the tough part about the playoffs in today's NBA. I don't mean to use that in like a analytic ball type beat. It's more just like, okay, if everyone can kind of play at a certain pace and rhythm and tempo, if you decide to smash the transition button like Toronto did in the first half, you're a team that was trying to figure out how to get stops. You did that. You did not turn that into points. And you still were able to compete, but you did not turn those into points. Like, use that as an opportunity. I think you have to be so timely in transition in today's NBA in the playoffs to where, okay, maybe we don't have the home run in transition, but we can get into something early and put pressure on you and get something we like. Like Orlando was really timely in transition against Detroit, right? Like a lot of what they did was not fast. But the moments they were, boy, it hit Detroit in the stomach. Toronto did the opposite. They kind of just like, well, let's get another stop. And it's like, you're trying to figure out how to do that. You can't do that. On top of having some half court, where are we going things, it gets tough.
Yeah, just 2 quick things there on that and we can move. Like to that point, over a 19 transition frequency for Toronto in that game, and they just did not score enough, a lot of that being the turnover issue. Because they were working the go so fast, I think it was a reaction to what their game one was, where the Cleveland Cavaliers effectively said, you are not getting into the paint in any capacity. And so for them to have in game two a 49% rim rate is good on the surface. I was very impressed with Scotty Barnes in the second half of the game, finally deciding, you know what? I am just bigger than a lot of these dudes. I'm just going to put my head down. RJ Barrett had some really timely drives in that second half. He's just had a good driving series overall through two games. But again, the Raptors don't have the result to show for it. But it's like, okay, that part's cool. But like, you have to have a complete game put together. And like, I was intrigued early second quarter to the cross-matching bit. Scotty Barnes, you are now defending Donovan Mitchell. Makes sense. Let's put our best guy on their best guy in this lineup. Let's put some length there. We're going to have RJ Barrett on the big. We turn those pick and rolls into switches. But then, very, very, oh, Scotty Barnes on Donovan Mitchell. We are neutralizing him as a help defender. Or early pick and roll, we're just going to switch you off of that matchup. We're going to attack anyway, and now he's further from the basket, so you don't have that either. Here's a seal from Evan Mobley, as you mentioned earlier, Steve, with Donovan mm-hmm. Mitchell stashed in the weak side corner, so Scotty Barnes cannot preload to that. It's just like, a hat tip to Kenny Atkinson and staff, honestly, because Toronto did a lot of good, smart, conceptual things, and the Cavs, in the half court in particular, just had answers for all of it. So, like, they deserve credit. And then the last thing before we move, Steve, very disappointed in Brandon Ingram in this basketball game. To have Cleveland deserves credit with their off-ball physicality and making sure he doesn't get clean off those pin downs and things like that. But like, 9 shots in game one, it is, hey, I was being used as a screener, but like, it's not, you know, 9 shots ain't gonna be enough. I need to be more aggressive. You come out in the first quarter, you miss all of your shots. You have some of the lapses that you have defensively, with the effort lapses that you have. Like, one possession I clipped was Cleveland getting like 4 offensive rebounds on one possession, and Brandon Ingram was largely nowhere to be found. It's just like, hey, man, the Raptors need you to make shots and to play make. You need to be a pressure point. Mm-hmm. It's got to be better than what it was in game two. It's just got to be better than that.
Another year, another Nekias Duncan and Brandon Ingram rant. Scotty Barnes is treated one way. The other one, you talk to HR. We've done this before. before we move, salute to James Harden, Donovan Mitchell. Understand the assignment, nailing it, and saying, you know what, James Harden, I want switches. I'll attack switches. I'll punish switches. Donovan Mitchell, do whatever he does. It's been a good core effort. If I'm Toronto, I got to be able to find a way to poke at the lineups and make Kenny Atkinson make different decisions. But if you wanted the concept of what James Harden and Donovan Mitchell were supposed to be together in the playoffs, you got it in the first two games. And so James Harden's drives have been key. His ability to attack matchups has been key. Donovan Mitchell has never stopped. And you add in, okay, Evan Mobley, you have your moments. Jared Allen, you stay aggressive. And we have the tag teams of Max Strus mm-hmm. and Sam Merrill and Keon Ellis and Dennis Schroeder that we can deploy with the Jalen Tyson portion, which has been interesting because he did not have a good time with Brandon Ingram. And then he did not really have a good time with Scotty Barnes. And so it's like, I get what we're doing here, but whatever. But we got to keep moving.
He's having a time. Fun Cleveland through the first two games of the series. Okay, Steve, the Oklahoma City Thunder in their game one against the Phoenix Suns, a 119-84 victory. I think it was a 62 offensive rating in the half court for the Phoenix Suns in this one. Just a dominant defensive effort. How concerned are you about the Phoenix Suns based on what we saw in game one?
Oh, so if you texted the Phoenix Suns, you get a call back in return right away.
Oh.
You wouldn't even get a text. Okay. They'd call you right back.
Oh, dear. Okay. That's pretty clear. So, yeah, that too.
Here's what I'll say is, Oklahoma City is a very good defensive team. Oklahoma City displayed a high level of activity on the defensive end of the floor in game one. They had ball pressure from their elite defensive personnel to bother the Suns guards. Chet Holmgren and Isaiah Hartenstein were able to be close to the level, contain, engage. The weak side was able to help. When Phoenix wanted to try and get off-ball actions for Devin Booker, for Jalen Green, try and get a flow, OKC was physical, and they had bogged things down. They were able to deny. When Phoenix wanted to drive, hey, guess what? Baseline rotation, or there's going to be help, or you're trying to drive, and it's a very good defender. Mm-hmm. There were not a lot of windows open for Phoenix, and they closed very quickly. And my concern level is, okay, you had 24 points in the paint. You had, like, a grand total of 2 fast break points when the game mattered. You are having to operate in the half court to a degree against this team who is basically saying, you know what, we're going to try and take everything away from you, and we know you have talent in Devin Booker and Jalen Green and Dylan Brooks. They're going to have to beat us in a very specific way. And that's where my concern mm-hmm. lies. Can you unlock things offensively against this Thunder defensive unit? What are you going to be able to unlock? Because you cycled through a lot of different things. You went pass and cut. You went dribble handoff. You went straight pick and roll. OKC was able to feel comfortable through multiple lineups defending and bothering you.
Yes.
And if you don't have enough of the offense, we can't get to the annoying defense part, where I think Phoenix overall looks at what they try to do against Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and you probably say, hey, you know what? We got him to shoot 5 of 18 from the field. He went 15 of 17 from the line. We don't have to talk about it. You guys can do that on your own. But we're going to show all this. We're going to show all this early help. We're going to take away your driving lanes. We're going to have the defenders that can harass you, contest your step backs, your fadeaways. We're going to help on your drives. We're going to feel real good about that. OKC said, hey, here's Jalen Williams one pass away. How do you feel about that, buddy? And as the game progressed, hey, let's drive this second closeout once you're planning on help and see how you feel about that. And hey, let's get some pick and roll to start the third quarter with Shai and Isaiah Hartenstein. You want to put two on the ball there. Now, what do you do if you're Phoenix and Shai makes some of those shots that you can't live with, or he gets the drives going in a way that you can't live with? You didn't have to deal with all of that. Jalen Williams is like, cool, I'll cook. Chet was like, hey, you put a wing on me. Wasn't great to start. I'll cook. The fact that OKC can play better than they did in game one is where my concern level is for Phoenix. Not disrespect to Phoenix. It's more so, yeah, that's a callback. That's a, hey, man, I don't know how to say this, but yeah, that's where Phoenix is at right now. Back to the drawing board.
Oh, I guess to answer in your vein, I think this is very much a you see the text and you see the blue text at the middle. Like this is silence. We on D&D right now. We ain't even trying to. we ain't trying to hear nothing right now. In all seriousness, I'm probably at an end. It's less that OKC was as rude as they were defensively, and I think you nailed it. With Phoenix did good things against Shai. He didn't have the same shot making thing. I think the playmaking for Shai was pretty strong in this game. and again, as you mentioned, Chet and Jalen were able to play off of that, so there are positive things there. For me, I kind of go to the size thing, because one of the questions that I had for Phoenix heading into the series is like, okay, what does your small lineup look like against OKC's small lineup? And considering they did not have Mark Williams, and I'm not sure what his status is going to be for game two, once Oso Iguodala, who if you talk about the few bright spots that Phoenix had, I love the Oso game. But when Oso goes to the bench, it's Haywood Highsmith, Heat legend Haywood Highsmith at the five sometimes. And to see OKC with Isaiah Hartenstein also on the bench, early foul trouble, OKC getting busy on the offensive glass with no Hartenstein, like that is that's an orange flag at the very least for me. No pun intended with the Phoenix Suns, I guess. But that's an orange flag for me. It's like, hey, if you're getting dinged on the offensive glass when OKC isn't even really the we're hunting these team, you are too small if this is what is happening here. And so in addition to how rude OKC was defensively, Phoenix just could not get going. Devin Booker didn't have a good time. Jalen Green especially didn't have a good time. Some of the cross-match from OKC was interesting. Here's Chet on Jordan Goodwin. He goes down. Here's Chet on Colin Gillespie. I was like, wait a minute. I didn't think that is where they were going to go. So they mixed in some fun stuff. Phoenix has to be able to generate some stuff offensively. They're going to need the three-point volume in their favor. But they're also going to have to find the lineups that can kind of match what OKC does in the front court. They're going to have to win the small minutes more than they did. Because if you're losing the Iguodala minutes because OKC has their starters out there, then you downsize. You just can't stop the paint attacks or in possession. We're running out of options at that point. So I'm at an 8 with the Phoenix Suns. We move quickly to the Eastern Conference. The Boston Celtics with a 123-91 victory over the Philadelphia 76ers. Jason Tatum was fantastic. Jaylen Brown, very good. Peyton Pritchard lost his mind for stretches of that game. Where are we at with the Philadelphia 76ers heading into game two?
You ever check in on someone and they give you the earnest paragraph that you weren't expecting?
Yes. Absolutely. That's what that is.
That's the Sixers right now. That's the Sixers right now. I think it's a reality. You saw what the idea of the formula was for Philly in that game one, where, okay, we're going to be physical. We're going to be active defensively. We're going to try and bog Boston down. We feel good about that. And then offensively, you feel like we can get enough buckets on the other end. The only problem is they couldn't defend at a high enough level and sustain that. And they couldn't get enough buckets. And it only got worse as the game went on. And I think when you're looking at what these teams did, right, this is a tough matchup for this specific Sixers team against this specific Boston Celtics team. A Boston Celtics team that says, hey, you know what? We're going to control what we can control. And so we are going to work to not turn the ball over. We are going to work to move the basketball. We're going to work to get back in transition by crashing the glass. So we're going to take away transition points. We're going to work to protect the paint in various ways. And so we're going to show early help against you, Tyrese Maxey. We're going to show late help and collapse on your drives. We're going to mix things up. High pick and roll. You think Nikola Vucevic or Nemes Keita is a duck? Well, guess what? We're going to navigate these screens to try and take away your pull up. If you turn that corner, a defender's coming out of nowhere to take that drive and keep you away from the paint. We're going to rotate and flow out, and we're going to make sure you not don't have a good time. And so Philly cycled through different things offensively, trying to get, you know, they created good looks, I felt like, where they just didn't knock them down in the first half. Second half, okay, let's get movement on one side, go side to side, and force you to move. And you got to a point where Boston dealt with it. Philadelphia had to reset, and they were in low clock scenarios. And so excuse me, I think their game plan execution against Tyrese Maxey was so good. Their defense was so good without totally having to go into the gimmick of we're just going to switch everything or we are going to put a small lineup out there. And I think Jason Tatum was phenomenal in that first half as far as just reminding you, yeah, I'm back. I'm playing well. The playmaking is on point. You want to put two on the ball. I'm going to make the right read. I'm going to make the right play. I'm going to attack transition. We're going to run this flare action for me. I'm going to get downhill. I'm going to do what I do. Derek White nailed so many rotations. So I think Boston is locked in to a degree that constrains the Sixers team to where I could see how they would try to build this boat. But if it's going to be this tough on Tyrese Maxey and it's going to be this tough on Paul George and the defense is only going to hit this many levels, a three-point variance game is going to give you something. You might be able to hang around and get into a fourth quarter battle. Do you have enough things to shift Boston off of what they want to do? I'm not certain.
Okay. No, I think to your latter point, like I'll probably answer no as of today. If they have enough to just completely shift Boston, your hope is just that, like, okay, it doesn't matter if they shift, we just got to make more shots. And so I think panic meter for me is probably at a 6, which may just be lower than other folks, but similar to the Toronto bit in game 2, I felt good about a lot of what Philly was doing conceptually. Like, even to your point about Tyrese Maxey turning the corner, someone's going to float from the wing, that guy's not going to take the corner, et cetera. Like, they were able to find stuff against that. Like, Tyrese Maxey himself made the reads. There was also a possession, I think VJ Edgecombe was initiating pick and roll. You had Tyrese Maxey like 40 feet from the basket on the left side. And so Boston tried to do that gambit again as VJ tries to turn the corner. And now it is Tyrese Maxey running into a catch and getting down him. It's like, okay, y'all are doing stuff. Defensively, here's our activity. Here's our physicality. Like, this is good. You do have to execute. You do have to make shots. I'll just quickly say, half joking, half serious, Kelly Oubre was my X factor for the Sixers heading into the series. After the dunk, like, I just stopped clipping Oubre-related possessions in my thread because I felt like it was just going to come off mean if I did. The defense, I just did not love it. But, like, either way, like, I think there's stuff there for Sixers. I don't think they're going to shoot as poorly as they did in game 1. And, like, that alone should make this more competitive, I think. But I was fine with what their game plan was. Some of the lineup stuff got funny as you had foul trouble for Andre Drummond. You had foul trouble, I think, for Adam Bona as well. So then at that point, it's like Don Barlow at the 5. It's like, well, I am a fan of Don Barlow. More so, like, as a 4, they kind of mix into that 5 role for spurts. Not, we need you to be the center. And so we will see what that portion looks like heading forward. But I'm at the 6. Last one, Steve. The San Antonio Spurs defeating the Portland Trail Blazers 111-98. Victor Wembanyama with 35 points in his playoff debut. Where are we at with the Blazers after that game 1? How concerned should we be?
The Blazers probably responded with cool and 3 emojis. Who knows what that means?
Okay.
Could be great. Could be bad. I think for Portland, you had an idea and a formula of what they wanted to do defensively, especially with saying, hey, Donovan Clingan, you're going to guard Stephon Castle, and we're going to be able to put ourselves in a position where Wimby, your roles and your drives contained into Stephon Castle. 1, Victor Wembanyama did not care. 2, the Spurs decided, let's invert and use Stephon Castle as a big. So you be the hub for us. You run dribble handoffs. You run pick and roll. So I thought it was funny where it's just like they go to inverted pick and roll. Stephon Castle screens of Wimby and he hits a early 3 and it's like, oh, this is what we're doing here. And then I think in the second half, the Spurs call a timeout and they end up having Stephon Castle screen and roll for a lob. And it's like, oh, this is what we're doing. On top of what the Spurs want to do defensively, which is like, hey, how many points are you going to get where you really feel good about what you're doing in the half court consistently because of what Victor Wembanyama does? And how things can kind of progress and get tricky. And so because of how the Spurs lay things out, okay, cool. Wemby comes out, Luke Kornet comes in. We're going to go small ball to start the second quarter. I'm sure we're going to be able to switch and cause some havoc. Here's Victor Wembanyama, who has decided, hey, you want to switch these actions? I'm going to try and hit you as best I can, finish through the contact. I'm going to slip these screens. I'm going to execute and do different things offensively. And so I think they showcased enough of where we could get the Spurs into a pickle. I think the Spurs responded in a way that said, you know what? Devin Vassell, De'Aaron Fox, we know who we are. We play defense. We're not necessarily going to play that. And so how they progress once Portland has shown their hand, that's where it gets to an interesting game too.
Okay, I think that's fair. Like, I'm also at like a 6 for the Blazers right now. Because I think largely defensively, they, the cross-matching in particular, I think they kind of did their job. Like, I think they kind of executed that to the degree that they could. The Spurs had a 90.5 offensive rating in the half court in game one. Their overall offensive rating was lower than the regular season mark. Like, I think they, as much as you can reasonably bog down the Spurs offense, they kind of did that. Bigger issue for me is that outside of Denny Avdia, what could you consistently get to? And in general, when Wimby's in the game, how consistently could you get to the rim? Those things left me seriously wondering heading into this game, too. Like, you got some spurts from Scoot, but it wasn't enough. And even Denny, as the game went on, it felt more jumper heavy for him as the game went on. And the Spurs, like, actually, you're not getting any more of these. Like, very cool off-ball actions to get you to your right hand, et cetera. Let's slow this down a little bit. So many threes from Donovan Clingan and Robert Williams. Like, I think just from a pure variance standpoint, they're going to shoot better at some point. It may just be game two. It may be the rest of the series. We'll see. I am kind of in a general good place with their defense conceptually. They got to score, though. They have to find a way to loosen the shackles in the half court in terms of getting into the paint and thus getting to the rim. And then we'll see what the three-point shooting ultimately ends up. So I'm at a 6 right now with them. We're going to take a break from here, Steve. When we return, we shift to the W side. Some interesting storylines as we get ready. We got some media days, some training camps kicking off, etc. Let's talk some W to close this thing out. We'll be right back. And we are back with this episode of The Dunker Spot. Steve, let's shift to the W. Media days are starting to trickle in. I'm very excited. I'm going to be in Vegas over the weekend / into early next week as they have their media day next Tuesday. So excited about that. But lots of things are happening as we get close to preseason play and the regular season thing. So I just wanted to run some ideas by you, Steve. Some things just kind of percolating into mind right now. Some things I'm thinking about as we head into, you know, preseason action this weekend and just in general as we get into these media days. So top of mind for me right now, in terms of storylines that I'm kind of following as we get deeper into this, I and a lot of other people are curious to see what happens with Natasha Cloud, who is still a unrestricted free agent and is, I think, I don't want to say pretty easily because that sounds disrespectful, but I think fair to say she is the best unrestricted free agent available right now. You know, Tina Charles also has a case. Emma Mieseman, if she wants to return to the W still, what else? But very much a notable name in the free agency market. And she recently posted on Threads, "I've given my heart to every team and community I've been part of, never fully knowing if the impact that I hoped for was truly felt. In this moment, though, receiving so much love, support, and advocacy means everything. It's a powerful reminder that the impact I've wanted to make beyond the court is real and aligned with what I believe God has called me to do through this game. I'm okay just taking things in, even if they weren't what I expected, and trusting I'll be all right." And I'm just in an interesting spot with the Cloud free agency. Like, this could be just a matter of, this is a very condensed offseason. Teams want to have their rosters together as quickly as possible. As we're talking about the Natasha Cloud news, we also got the news earlier this week that she's changing agencies, I would imagine, based on what this free agency period has been for her. So I don't know. I don't have sourcing on what the contract demands were compared to conversations she had with the Liberty or the teams or whatever. So there's only so much information I have from the outside. But for someone that can defend as well as Natasha Cloud can, someone that can still drive as well as she does, just had her career best season in terms of converting shots inside the arc with the Liberty, it's kind of hard to rectify how she hasn't at least gotten like training camp offer somewhere, if not just firm protected contract somewhere. So like, I guess for me, I guess I'll toss the question to you, like, what do you make of her still being available right now?
I think it's tough. I think Natasha Cloud is a high impact player. on both ends of the floor with her ability to drive and play make and ability to defend multiple positions and impact the team that way and just kind of elevate the compete level and the winning factor for a team. I think if you look at the basketball portion of it with the sprint aspect, with the sprint aspect of this offseason, with the draft, how many teams pivoted or chose a direction? And what did that do as far as the options that Natasha Cloud may have had? I don't know. You know, it's speculation to a degree, but I think there are fits. Like, but if you're Washington, we're young. We're trending young, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of takes that off the table. If you're a Toronto, we got Marina Mabry. We got Brittany Sykes. We got Julie Alamon. We drafted Kiki Rice. We've shifted in a direction. Right. If there's mm-hmm. if you're the Seattle Storm and you decided to choose to go with Natisha Heidemann, that was your choice. That took that off the board to a degree because you brought back Jade Melbourne. Not to say that Natasha Cloud couldn't impact any team in the W, but it now mm-hmm. becomes, OK, what did these teams decide to do? If you're Portland, you're all in on developing talent and having different varieties of versatility. So I think there that might be a fit. What does that look like? Phoenix, can you go back? Are we just deciding to run it back? What are we doing? Obviously, whatever happened with the Liberty is what it is. Minnesota, we have Olivia Miles now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Spark, we got Ariel Atkins. Like, the Aces, we're doing continuity. The Fever, we have to pay Caitlin Clark and Aaliyah Boston a lot of money, and we brought Kelsey Mitchell back. Like Golden State was probably the one where I was like, hey, are you guys going to knock on the door? Because that's a fit to a degree. But it's like Dallas, yeah, we have Paige and Arike, and we just drafted AZ Fudd. Mm-hmm. Connecticut, we're going young. Chicago, we got Skylar Diggins and brought Sloot back. Atlanta, we brought Jordan Canada back, and we have Tina Pow Pow. So it's like, it's not to me that Natasha Cloud can't help a team. It's more so, did teams just decide, this is the route we're going? These are the players we got, and now we're focusing on adding a big or the draft picks who we get in the draft or getting added into our wing room. Did that happen? It's unfortunate.
Yeah, like I think it is very unfortunate because, as you mentioned, like she still can make impact on both ends of the floor. We saw that last year. We saw that in the playoff series last year against the Phoenix Mercury, like where it feels like every year now, oh, it's playoff time. Natasha Cloud is going to knock down every off the dribble jumper she takes and also defend like a bad person. You know what I mean? But I think the team direction point is a strong one, Steve. Like I was trying to think through what are the landing spots that would make sense for her right now. Like I was like Phoenix because she's been there before. And as they have brought what feels like 57 people in on training camp for training camp, to solidify their roster. She's like, well, she is just an established vet. She's been there before. She can defend multiple positions. Like, there's already prior history there with Nate Tibbetts, et cetera. But I don't know what that organizational relationship is like. Because it was Natasha Cloud, you were forever Mercury, and then you were traded to Connecticut in part to help bring Satu Sabli and Alyssa Thomas in. So it's like, okay, are there still hard feelings there? I don't know the answer to that. Portland has all the cap room, but they have Carla Late, who I would assume is going to be PG1. But like that of the expansion teams, like I think Portland would make more sense than Toronto because they just have not allocated that amount of salary. And then the other point guard on the roster right now, if you're not counting Shook Sutton, is Nika Mule, who's going to be out again with the ACL injury. So like there is literal financial and roster room, I think, if they want to go that route. But there's also an argument to make like, no, actually, we want to just turn this over to Carla Late, who can drive all over the place, draw all kind of fouls. Let's just see what this is. Seattle, I think it was a strong one, which I am just intrigued by Seattle as a concept as I was in the Zoom, but like part of their media day, like the vibes just seem fantastic. You know, media day vibes are always fantastic, but they seem to really like what Sonya Robin is bringing to the table there. But she is still technically an upgrade over Natisha Heidemann and Jade Melvin. And like, based on it being this late in the cycle, I don't anticipate this is Natasha Cloud 1 year, $1 million contract. So like that still feels like a fit, especially if you're going to have some lineups where she can kind of be the nominal three. And you're going double two guards with Dom and Alfam whenever she comes over, whatever, whatever. So, like, Seattle still makes some sense. Washington, depending on what the organizational relationship is like there. Because they, as you mentioned, they are young. They are so young. I think they have, what, two players on their training camp roster whose date of birth does not start with a two in terms of the year. I think veteran leadership could be helpful there. I would personally worry about, like, okay, you know, similar conversation we had about the draft. I like all these talents. Who shoots? And so, like, adding Natasha Cloud to that mix may complicate some of the, like, on-court development from a spacing perspective. But she's still very good, and I think she would just be their best point guard today. Especially if George Abor isn't ready to, like, really take the reins of that position. So, like, Seattle and Washington are probably the two, and keeping an eye on Phoenix. But it is just kind of tough what the landscape of the league is right now and how condensed all of this was and how teams want to get this ready. Like, again, we'll talk about it more on Friday, but preseason action is happening on Saturday. Like, training camp started this past Sunday. We're getting our first preseason action 6 days after that. Like, teams just kind of want to know who and what they have. And this is just more tough than anything. I do hope that Natasha Cloud finds a roster spot and finds one that fits her, because she is still very good. But that's just at the top of mind for me. As we cycle through some of these other teams, Steve, the Aces, as I kind of made the half-hearted joke that the Mercury have brought in, feels like 40 people into their training camp. The Aces brought in 13. It is their 11 vets, with 8 of them returning from last year's rosters. And it is the two rookies, Jahnai Barker and Jordan Obi, which was they had like a rookie availability for them yesterday. And they are just so – they sound so mature for their age. And they just seem to be really soaking up the experience. Like, I'm excited for them on that front. But I am curious about what this Aces – I guess just the overall decision-making. Like, we're not even about to play with adding in outside names and then trimming things down. And so the question I have for you, Steve, is did you take that in as any sort of, like, maybe not odd, but, like, just how did you kind of soak in how small the training camp roster is for the Aces compared to everyone else?
We got who we got. We are who we are. I think it's a play on continuity. You can argue if that's a positive play or not. But when you go through that kind of journey last year and you end up a champion, let's not put ourselves back in the box of trying to figure out who we are. Let's build on what we did and see if we can do that better. And so I get understanding, okay, you got there, but X, Y, Z. No. We built a base, and I think we can be better. I think we can get better contributions from the players that were new last year. They're not going to be new. So we have the all-level, all-world talent that Asia Wilson is. We have Jackie Young. We have Chelsea Gray. We bring these people back who know more of what we want to do, know more of how we operate, know more of what will be expected of them. And then we add in pieces like Kennedy Carter. We add in, you know, probably the version of Cheyenne that we were looking to get last year. We add in a Stephanie Talbot. Okay, is this the pot that we can now already have a little bit more pre-made than last year, where we really, hey, it was too warm, it was too salty, it was too this. I know this can be a good dish, and eventually you made it. But now, okay, I know the recipe. Let's add to it. I think that is the concept of the Aces, especially in a condensed offseason where a lot of teams are going in different directions or trying to add different pieces to what they're doing and trying to figure out who they are. We know what we are. We may have flaws, but we know what the high end can be, and we're going to try and build on what we did last year. So I think it would probably be more weird if the Aces tried to just pivot into something completely different than running it back.
Okay, I feel that. And I think similar to what we talked about during the Kennedy segment last week, it was intriguing to me that the philosophical shift seems to be more like we are making a swing on talent and trusting our locker room. Like, we're bringing Kennedy Carter in, we're bringing Jahnai Barker in. We're just very much a high upside swing in terms of the talent. Based on what the college profile was. And, like, we're going to do that versus let's cast a wide net and bring in 20, 25 players and then trim things down. Becky Hammon was talking about this after training camp, post-practice scrum. And she said, like, one, I don't like cutting people to begin with. But on top of that, like, I do just kind of want to know who I have in the building. I do kind of want to streamline this. I want to be able to build off of what we did last year. So, Steve, I think you nailed it. I don't know if you've heard the actual Becky answer yet or not, but you kind of nailed what her logic is behind it. And I think the logic is understandable. For me, as I zoom out, like, I always just love for teams to cast the net. Like, let's look overseas. Let's see who the shooters are, who the defenders are, et cetera, et cetera. Can we find some things on the margins to help us? Like, I'm always going to be pro that versus let's just run it back completely. But I think the Aces have room to believe we should just run this back for all the reasons that you made. So I think that's a smart one. The other thing I'll add on the Aces front before we move, Dana Evans still out, and the Aces recently announced that she is out indefinitely as she is recovering from a left leg injury. She played one game in Unrivaled. That was midway through the season. Didn't see her again. Was officially ruled out before the playoffs started. So I can't confirm it yet. I've been asking around, but, like, I think this is related to, whatever that leg injury was that she was dealing with during Unrivaled, and also something that she alluded to having, you know, wanted to get that fixed in her exit interviews after the championship. So hopefully she's just okay. She said so on Twitter and on Threads, hey, y'all, I'm okay, just rehabbing and doing everything I can to get back on the court. I'll be fine. And so we will see if she is ready for, you know, the preseason action that the Aces are in, or ready for the regular season. It certainly puts more of a spotlight on the Kennedy Carter signing. Like, oh, no, we need you to be a part of this guard room. And I'll say at least early on, because I posed this to you, like, hey, if we're getting Kennedy plus Dana, like, the backcourt can be is talented, but it can be small in some of these lineups, et cetera. If it is just now Kennedy, that does simplify some of the potential size questions that you may have. So, again, we'll get preseason films next week, et cetera, to see how those rotations may work out. But wanted to bring that to your attention as well. To the Atlanta Dream, Steve, and also sprinkling in some injury news. Bree Jones suffered an injury in January while playing overseas. She's still recovering from that, had surgery recovering from that. She's out indefinitely as well. And so I already had general questions about what the Angel Reese fit was going to be. I think we both agreed that it is a strong one on both ends of the floor, at least conceptually. But now with Bree Jones out of the mix, does this now mean we are looking at an Angel Reese, Naz Hillman starting front court now? And if so, what does that look like on both ends of the floor? Do they shift what they do schematically at all? That's more so of a defensive question for me, because this Atlanta group last year was a solid defense, first and foremost. But they were very much, we'll bring our bigs up to the level sometimes, but we are going to drop. Angel Reese, I think, is more comfortable playing at the level or switching out. And so, like, do we see a real bend from Carl Smesko on that front, or is it going to be more of the same? Which kind of circled me back to the conversation we were having during Team USA play. And I was like, hey, I kind of like that Angel's getting reps at the five and that she's having to navigate different coverages, because she didn't get to do a ton of that in Chicago, just playing alongside Camila Cardoso, Elizabeth Williams, et cetera. I think the five reps are going to come now. Bree Jones misses the beginning of the season. Again, we'll get a firmer timeline a little bit later, I hope. But I'm curious about what the Angel integration defensively is going to look like even more now. So where are you at with the Dream in light of the Bree Jones news?
Well, I think it's a big Angel Reese let's go moment, if you think about it. And I think Angel Reese's quote, I don't have it directly, but it's like, hey, I would like to be coached. I want to be pushed into the uncomfortable elements of the game of basketball. And so I think you now have a situation where Angel Reese can play at the five. And do we see a mashup of the work that she has put in with the initial run with the Sky in Unrivaled, the growth she's had defensively? Because we've seen activity. We've seen an ability to kind of hit multiple coverages. You can feel how you feel about the results, but we saw at the level, we saw mixing and switches. We saw rotations defensively. We saw being able to defend in space. And now, okay, what does this look like? We will get an answer and understand where we have to go. So now, we get all the answers we need about Angel Reese on the defensive end as Bree Jones is on the sideline and waiting for her to come back. And, you know, obviously they had Bree and Brittany Griner last year. I think Naz Hillman was excellent as far as being able to do multiple things defensively and offensively and cover up. But now we can kind of, I think Angel Reese is a little bit more moldable as far as, okay, there are things that you could do. We may ask you to do different things, as opposed to, you know, we saw a level of activity from Bree Jones being at the level, but it was at the level I'm going to drop back, right? With Brittany Griner, was hoping we can get a mix, but it's also I'm going to be in this drop. With Angel Reese, can that kind of be the inflection point of the evolution of what Atlanta may want to do, but also we can do a little bit more because Angel can do a little bit more? And so that's where it gets interesting to see what is the attempt they want to make and what does Angel's activity look like at the five purely.
Yeah, like that's largely where I am. Like, also, just shout out to Angel, who just seems to be incredibly happy, just glowing after all the practice interviews and all the things that I've seen. Just very much a can't believe this is my life, et cetera. And so happy for her on that front. But I think you nailed it with the defense portion. Like, how much is she going to be asked to do? How much of what she brings to this table is going to be tapped into now? And even beyond Angel now. If it is going to be Angel and Naz, like, there's more of a spotlight on the players behind them. Nia Coffey, who's long been like a versatile defensive piece for Atlanta in Minnesota now. I love the Medina Okot pick for Atlanta because, oh, they got Bree Jones, they got Naz Hillman, they got Angel Reese. We don't need you to be good yet. We ultimately want you to be, and we think you have high upside. We don't need you to be good yet. Does that shift at all now that Bree Jones is out? Is it now, hey, we kind of need, you know, two stints? We need 10 to 13 minutes a game. That still isn't a ton in the grand scheme of things, but like, oh no, we actually kind of need you to give us two good stints a game now, because we don't have like the pure five, the pure sizable five now. Ruby Jones out. Like, I'm curious to see what the downstream effects of that's going to be. And so, again, that's why I wanted to bring that to your attention, Steve. Like, that's also just kind of percolating as we're going to be getting more out of training camp and more clips hitting the timeline and all of those things. And the last thing I kind of alluded to a little bit earlier, I just kind of wanted to check in with Seattle as this team looks very different. If we're sticking with injury news, Ezzie Mattbegor suffered an injury, foot injury during FIBA World Cup qualifier. She's going to be out at least 6 to 8 weeks. Awafam still in international competition. I think she's in the playoffs overseas, so at training camp yet, but will be soon. But with Ezzie out, first, please recover fully, etc. Second, we're going to see Dom plus Awa together a lot earlier than I anticipated, or at least with a higher volume than I anticipated early this season, I would imagine. And just broadly speaking, as I was in the Zoom for their media day, just listening at the players rave about Sonya Rahman and her communication style, Lexi Brown said, like, she's had, I think, 9 different head coaches. This, you know, her introductory talk with Sonya was like the longest she's had with a head coach and being able to get into different concepts because of her NBA background and things like that. I was like, okay, this is interesting. Every player that was asked about Sonya was complimentary. Zaya Cook, in particular, was like, I loved, like, our film sessions have been so much more positive in showcasing, like, what I'm doing right in addition to, like, what I need to correct, et cetera, et cetera. They all talked about, like, how straightforward she is at the same time. And so there's a level of base accountability there. The theme that kind of came out from talking to Sonya was positionless basketball and wanting players in different roles. So I just kind of wonder, like, oh, how often are we going to have Dom Malanga bringing the ball up the floor? How often is Awafam going to be bringing the ball up the floor? How often are we going to see inverted pick and rolls with those bigs? Lexi Brown talked about wanting to ramp up her screening in anticipation of the offense looking a little different. So I just kind of have my brow raised with Seattle as a concept right now, Steve. Also, Flage just seems, she just, I don't think she stopped smiling since she was traded to Seattle. But I'm just intrigued with what the Seattle group is going to look like and if they ultimately land in the standings. Where are you at with the Seattle Storm?
Well, I think the Golden State stock that you had last year, you'll probably convert to Seattle Storm stock if I know you very well, just because of what they have versatility-wise and roster-wise. And I think it's more of a building moment based on what Sonya has done in the past and what she may look to do in the future and the versatility this roster has and having Dom, having Ezzie, having Awafam, those are players that can do dynamic things. And now you are attempting to build a culture. So I don't think there's necessarily a certain thing you're trying to achieve as far as we need to do X, Y, and Z. I think you have the room to build something. I think that's very important in the W. Not easy to do, but I think being able to lay the foundation, say, hey, this is who we are, this is what we do, this is what we can be, and improving on that. And so I think that's where Seattle's at the stage of, okay, can we be this offensively? Can we be this defensively? Can we build something that is new as opposed to, if you look at the core they had, right, where it's like we have Skylar Diggins, we have NECA, we have Gabby Williams. Within that, how do we fit people into that context? We are now building a new context. And so we can now learn on the fly and empower our players to play in different ways and contribute on the offensive defensive end. So I'm more just excited to see what the attempts are, what it looks like, how they grow throughout the season. But if you're talking about moxie, versatility, ability to drive, defense, I think there's a lot of things the Storm can present over the course of the season that'll make them a pretty fun team.
Yeah, I think they're going to be fun. We're going to circle back on you you clocking my tea on who I may enjoy this upcoming season. We got time for that before the season. Okay. Last thing before we get out of here, quickly on the news front, you mentioned the Golden State Valkyries. Tiffany Hayes, welcome back. She re-signed a 1-year deal. We have the Jonquel Jones terms, a 3-year deal, max with 5% raises compared to like just 17% every year. And Aaliyah Boston, in the biggest, you know, re-signing news that we have, via the new Epic provision, it's a renegotiation for the year 4 for rookie scale deal and then a 3-year extension on top of that. $1 million this year, and then the Supermax as the 3-year extension portion. So 20% of the cap in each of the next 3 seasons, 27, 28, and 29. That 4-year total edges out Asia Wilson for the largest WNBA contract signed in history. So first and foremost, salute to Aaliyah Boston coming off of a tremendous season, coming off of a tremendous unrivaled campaign. I am very excited about what she can be this year. And just in general with the Indiana Fever, you were talking about, you know, adding their card, who they have in the guard room, et cetera, in relation to Natasha Cloud, like the depth pieces that they added, like this Fever team, if they are healthy, and the bar is very low in terms of being healthier than they were last year, if they are healthy, they should be very good. I am also intrigued, though, because Aaliyah signs this via the Epic provision, as it was kind of revealed via Richard Cohen, her hoop stats, et cetera. It's not just, you know, you enter your third year, you can be eligible for this if you make an all-W team or win MVP. Second-year players can also trigger this if they're good enough, which means Caitlin Clark is also technically eligible for this right now. Now, again, the renegotiation would happen in year four, and then you have a three-year extension after that. But I'm just broadly looking at the win-now nature of this Fever team this season, because Aaliyah Boston's getting a pay bump now, and then it's going to be Supermax after that. Caitlin Clark is going to get a big pay bump very soon. Kelsey Mitchell is back, but she essentially signed her core designation qualifying offer. So that's 1 year at the Supermax, and she can't be cored again. There's a lot of pressure, I think. Not even trying to do the narrative thing, but just from a financial standpoint, this Fever team, I think, is going to be very good. They also kind of need to be very good, because as the payroll starts to skyrocket, this team can and likely will look very different over the next 2-3 seasons. So I just had the spotlight there. But overall, just a salute to Aaliyah Boston for earning this kind of money.
I'll go quick before I get yelled at by our producers, but I think this is the Fever swinging the fences and saying, we need to knock on the door of this top tier. We need to do it now. Like, the cap implications, I understand, but you know what? They send you that email about rent on like the 14th, and you don't look at it until the 8th, like 2 days before it's time to pay. What I would say is, like, okay, the Aces are the Aces. The Liberty have reloaded. The Lynx, hey. The Dream, understood, but hey. The Mercury, hey. Can we now ascend from where we were 6th last year, have full health, and now, like I talk about the Aces, we rely on some continuity as far as Caitlin Clark playing at a high level, Aaliyah Boston playing at a high level. We tried some things conceptually last year. Did we tighten the margins as far as the type of players we want and the additions we made? How impactful is a Monique Billings for our team? How impactful is, you know, having a Raven Johnson, Chitori Walker-Kimbrough, Ty Harris, as far as the type of things we want to do? We have a better understanding of Caitlin Clark and Kelsey Mitchell and how they can leverage different things. Are we now a team that can get off to a hot start, and we're a different conversation?
There we go. I think you nailed it, Steve. Thank you, Steve, for rocking with me. Thank you, dear listener or watcher, for hanging with us on this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main YouTube channel. That's where a lot of our W content is going for the YouTube folks. Audio listeners, you're just getting all of it at once. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. With that, we will catch y'all later in the week.